What I have to talk about is not about Mother's Day, because I wasn't planning on giving this talk this Sunday. It was going to be earlier. But I would still like to wish all the mothers a happy Mother's Day. And if you have issues appreciating your mother or your children's mother, you should go to church without either one of them and all of your kids, and then you will. What I would like to talk about today is sort of a, I guess it's sort of a testimony of why, what I believe and why I believe what I do. And I think there are questions that I have asked over the years, some that I didn't, that I probably should have. And I think everyone is in that situation where they go through life and there are questions that they should ask themselves. So in my mind, sort of the steps of belief, how it came to me, I was living in a Christian home. My parents went to church and they taught me the Bible, and the church taught me the Bible, and we had decent friends. And that's good. I think that's how a childhood should be. And then at some age, and it varies, it's hard to point to an exact point, but at some point you have to choose to make this belief your own. You're not just a child of a Christian. You then decide, is this also what I believe, or is this, well, now that I don't go to church with my parents, or I'm old enough to drive somewhere else, so I don't want to go anymore. Or do you own it for yourself and you decide that this is in fact what I believe? And then another step, which that's what's sort of prompting all this to come back to me now, is when you are then creating your own home and you are faced to either teach or not teach your children what you believe. And they ask questions and they want to know things, and that's as children should. They're curious, and then you have to ask yourself, well, what do I believe? How do I answer this question? And how do I want my 6-year-old to look at this? Is it truth, or are they too young for this still, or do I just give them the kids' picture Bible and let them figure it out for themselves? So that's the third step, where you're teaching your faith or worldview to others, in this case your children, but not always. And I'm going to use the term, three terms: faith, worldview, and religion. Religion is my least favorite term, because it, in my opinion, it's kind of loaded with unnecessary baggage in this time. But you can use it if you want. But to me, they're all sort of synonymous: religion and worldview, and even faith. I can explain that a little later. And then some of the questions that are asked, and some of the things that we read in the Bible that we've decided that we're going to believe, they're difficult. They're hard to. Some of them are hard to live out. Some of them are seemingly impossible to live out. And I will readily admit that some of them are uncomfortable. Sometimes it's like a context that you'll understand eventually. Some of it is just not what the world would approve of, and you have to live with that. And it's not that a popular thing, and it's just an uncomfortable thing. Those are the times when you have to ask yourself, well, what do I buy into this? Is this what I believe, and is this what I'm going to base my teaching and my life on? another option then is to you could just scrap the whole thing and say, no, I don't want to deal with the conflict. I would rather fit in and not go against the current. You could do that. Another option, which I see a lot, is that while there are no questions, without question, good ideas in the Bible. Our civilization is kind of built around that idea, and there are benefits to it. So you should, even if you don't believe it, you should live at least according to some of the rules. And that will benefit you somewhat, and it'll benefit society at large, I believe. But I don't believe it is sustainable. I don't think if it's based on truth, if you're just acting it out, and it's not going to last when it gets really tough, because there's no foundation there. And I've seen it where one generation, like my dad's generation, would be going to church, not that seriously. They would just go because everyone went. And then their children, they would take them along. But I don't think they taught them anything outside of church, and even in church, it was okay. It wasn't great. And those children no longer go to church. They might respect certain views that they got in church. They may not, or they might pick and choose. But I think unless you accept it as the actual truth, you will not be able to sustain the lifestyle if you're just kind of making it up. So I want to read from John. There's an example of some of this in John chapter 6. This is immediately after the feeding of the 5,000, I believe. And I think I'm going to start at verse 28. No, I'm not going to start there. Excuse me just a minute. Yeah, I'll start in 28. Then the crowd said to Jesus, "What must we do to be doing the works of God?" Jesus answered them, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. So they said to him, "Then what sign do you do that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform?" "Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written, 'He gave them bread and from heaven to eat.'" Jesus then said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of heaven, bread of God is he who gives down, I'm sorry, for the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." They said to him, "Sir, give us this bread always." Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst. But I said to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe. For all that the Father gives me will come to you, and whoever comes to me I shall never cast out." We'll stick with verse 39. "And then this is the will of him who sent me, that I should lose nothing of all that he has given me, but raise it up on the last day. For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who looks in the Son and believes in him should have eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day." So the Jews grumbled about him because he said, "I am the bread that came down from heaven." They said, "Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How does he say, 'I have come down from heaven'?" And Jesus answered them, "Do not grumble among yourselves. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day. It is written in the prophets, 'And they will all be taught by God.' Everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me." And I'm going to drop down a little bit to 51. "I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh." The Jews then disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" So Jesus said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in me. Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day. For my flesh is true food, and my blood is true drink. Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. And then going down to verse 60. When many of his disciples heard it, they said, "This is a hard saying. Who can listen to it?" But Jesus, knowing in himself that his disciples were grumbling about this, said to them, "Do you take offense at this? Then what if you were to see the Son of Man ascending to where he was before? It is the Spirit who gives life, and the flesh is no help at all." So this is Jesus is starting out, and from right off from the beginning, the people listening to him don't, they take him literally right from where he starts with, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him." And they say, they ask, what is the work that we need to do to be saved? The real answer is that there's no work that will save you. So they have the wrong mindset from right from the beginning. And then Jesus then adds the part that sort of offends them, and this is one of the parts that's uncomfortable for us too. He talks about eating his flesh and drinking his blood, and they take him literally again, and it's a metaphorical, of course. Where was I? 69. 62. Then what if you were to see the Son of Man ascending to where he was before? It is the Spirit who gives life. The flesh is no help at all. The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and life, but there are some of you who do not believe. For Jesus knew from the beginning who those were who did not believe and who it was who would betray him. And he said, "This is why I told you that no one can come to me unless it is granted by the Father." And this is one of the key verses. After this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. So Jesus said to the 12, "Do you want to go away as well?" So they couldn't. This is an example of where we've decided to follow a worldview, a faith, in this case, Jesus. And then it gets hard. We're faced with something uncomfortable. In this case, they didn't properly understand it, but it made them uncomfortable nonetheless. And it says many of them fell away. At that point, they decided, "This is not worth it to me. I'm not gonna bear down and try to understand this or in some way gain insight into this. I quit." Jesus asked his close disciples, his 12 disciples, "Do you want to go as well?" And Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." And that is that's the verse that kind of got me into this, what I'm teaching. And that's I was reading that, and there's no arguing with that verse anymore. Like, that's, Peter sort of settles it. He says, "Well, that's." He doesn't say, "Well, I fully understand what you just said, and, well, this is actually, this is metaphorical, I know, and I recognize that." I don't think he was comfortable with it either, but he had the faith to know, and he also had the knowledge that there wasn't anything better out there. This was it. If this wasn't going to save him, then there wasn't anything else out there. So he was willing to buy into it. And that's, I want to talk a little bit about that. About why I found that it's worth it to model a life after this and to place all your belief in this. And I want to go through a few questions. These are ones that I've heard growing up. I don't know where they're kind of very big questions. I'm sure lots of people have asked them before. And they're ones that everybody and really every worldview that claims to be legitimate should be able to answer or have an answer for. And they are, I think I'll just, yeah, there are four of them. I don't know if I'll talk about all of them. And the first one is origin, which is where did we come from? And you, if you go to school, I think, I've never been to school really. But from what I hear on the radio or everywhere else, the common answer for where we came from is that it was an accident. There was a huge explosion of something. And then a lot of time, and then gradually we came on this, and it's never fully explained. I was listening to some science thing on the radio, and they were talking about it, and then someone asks a question, maybe even a caller or somebody, and then this is absolutely what happened. The answer started to stumble and fumble, and then the moderator said, well, it's time for a break. That's all we have time for, and that was it. Because the truth is that there is no answer for it. They will say, or somebody else say that, yeah, I'm fine with all this. I'm fine with some of the beliefs and that you hold. Some of the ideas in Christianity are good. I just don't want to believe in magic, he says. And, but there's no origin story that does not require faith in a supernatural event or something like that. Does anyone know the first law of thermodynamics? Yes, exactly. Matter cannot be created or destroyed. It just transfers from one to the other. So there cannot be a creation from nothing, which is what has to have happened at some point. So that right there is what you would call a miracle. It's a suspension of a law of science. And then the second law. Does anyone know the second law? Yes, the second law is that the rule of the universe is that everything moves from order to disorder, from order to greater entropy or disorder. Yeah, your house and everyone else's and everything around you. And that is, like, that's a reality that stares us in the face. But that is the exact opposite of what we're expected to believe, if we're expected to believe what we're taught by most everyone these days. So again, that would be another miracle, so to speak, that would require tremendous amounts of faith, and nothing to ground the miracle on. Like, they don't at one time we're expected to believe something, and deny it. Ever happen because it's an impossibility at the same time. That doesn't really make sense. Did you have a question? Are you stretching?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's stretching. Do you think Jesus doubled down on the uncomfortable metaphor of being my friend? Yeah. Yeah. Because that's what he was doing. He was
I don't know who he was trying to show. I think some, certainly. I think he was... It's not the point of the talk, but I didn't study. It is a difficult question in that I don't know who he was trying to teach. Like, there's no question that those that fell away, he may or may not have seen again and taught again, and we don't know that. I certainly think there are other times when he wants people to take things more seriously, like the man who said, "Well, I've kept all these laws from my youth. And I've done this and this, everything that I'm supposed to. Am I a Christian now?" And is that the one Jesus says that you need to sell everything you have and give it to the poor? That is not actually what one needs to do to become a Christian. Yes, he was trying to make him think seriously about his mind. He wasn't even coming from the right premise, as this crowd was. And so there are times when I think Jesus does that. And that is, I don't know, going back to the things that I find uncomfortable, there are many times when I'm frustrated with how Jesus speaks in such unclear ways. Like, well, why didn't you just say it this way? Then everyone would have understood. And I don't always know the answer to that. That's part of the reason for this talk it's worth it. Partly because there are things that I have learned since I started studying these things, and they've made things a lot more clear. And also partly because of what Peter said, that, well, what else are we going to do? So I don't know if that was an answer to your question or not, but I don't know exactly why Jesus seems to not abandon, but yeah, he does kind of winnow the chaff away at times. And I think it is very relevant that his 12 disciples stayed. Like, he didn't do anything that would have taken them away. And that's ultimately what he built his church on, were those 12. Beyond that, I don't have an answer at the moment. Right. Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah, so I think I'll leave the first question at that. Basically, the origin requires, whatever your worldview of the origin, it is not a logical one unless there is some faith involved. Whether you believe in what the Bible says, or whether you believe in a creation without a God or a divine creator, there are miracles and a tremendous amount of faith involved in either one. The second question is that of morality. So it's origin, morality, which is, how do we know right from wrong? This is also a very, an inescapable reality that somehow we know, we have this internal sense of fairness and right and wrong. There's this, I think it was C.S. Lewis. I have a couple of quotes I might get to him. He takes the example of someone sitting on a train, or someone is walking, getting on a train, and then he trips over someone's leg who's stretched out, and he falls on his face, and that was an accident, and he was a little hurt and injured, but he was fine, and he took no offense because accidents happen. And then you could have the same amount of trauma and injury, except instead of the man sleeping, sticking his leg out, he deliberately trips him. And that we immediately know was wrong. Even though had the exact same amount of harm and effect, we can immediately tell in our mind that you shouldn't have done that. That was wrong. And life is full of those examples, and we have this. And then a very common argument against God is that how can there be a God if there's so much evil in this world, so much what we would call evil, because that's really undeniable. It doesn't take long to find, you can scan any newspaper or headline and find terrible things, like things we wouldn't even think about, and they're happening all the time. And why doesn't that mean that there's no God? When in reality, what I've come to see is that you would have no idea if it was evil if there was no God. If you're saying that there is evil, then you're saying, well, instead of this, there should be this, which would be good. By admitting evil, you're then also establishing that there's something on the other side, which is good. And as soon as you have that, then you must have some way to differentiate. There must be some law of values, a transcendent value system, that you can differentiate one from the other. And that would not, the animal kingdom does not have that. Humans have that because there is a lawgiver. There's an author to that transcends that was before that and that has defined it. And Romans says it's been put in our heart. Romans 1 says it's been put in our heart for us to know. Contrary to what people say, the reality of evil proves God rather than disproves him. The third question is that of meaning or purpose. Basically, why are we here? Why do we exist rather than we don't exist? And I don't want to get too abstract or anything, but it's it's sort of linked to the second question of, well, we know that, well, let me go from a different way. We could say that there's an inherent value that we see of existence. We even see it as a good thing. So it is very much tied to the second question, in that it's common sense. We understand it without even have to thinking about it. That's why we are here. And but existence is not really the same thing as meaning. One can exist and be terribly depressed and choose not to exist, and that unfortunately does happen. And without a moral compass, and without the ability to do right, without the ability to make things right, I would say that it is rather meaningless to exist. I would say part of the reason for us existing is to use that value system, and where we see things that are wrong, to then strive to make them right. So it does very much build on the second question. And there are a few verses. I forgot to write down the references also that I find. There's very little else out there that would give a good reason for existence and finding meaning in life other than what is spoken in the Bible. There's a should have looked it up. There's a debate once from Christopher Hitchens, and afterward, who's a famous atheist. Afterward, someone asked him, one of the audience question, about how would you determine meaning, or how would you advise a person find meaning in their life? And I'm not going to give his answer, partly because it was incredibly crass and sarcastic, and also because I don't know it word for word, but he basically didn't. He made a joke out of it because he didn't have an answer. That you can tell that when people are, if you make a joke, either then follow it up with the truth, or otherwise, that's all you got is to just mock it, and that's all there was. But there's a if someone knows where this verse is. I think it's in Micah. What is the whole duty of man? To love mercy, seek justice, and walk humbly with your God. And the idea of walking, you can certainly look at the first two, love mercy and seek justice. Those are both not what you would call animal instincts. They require a moral view of the situation. Mercy is something that is not, it requires empathy and love in them, and those are not scientific words. Those are very much biblical, spiritual words. But the idea of walk humbly with your God, the word walk reminded me of a lot of the old patriarchs from the Old Testament. It says they walked with God, I think Abraham and Enoch and maybe Noah. And maybe the most profound one was Adam before the fall. God would, in the still of the evening, it says that God would come down and walk with him in the garden. And that the idea there is fellowship and maybe teaching. I don't know what they were talking about. And camaraderie, and that is part of what I think God has for us. Like the reason God created us, I would say in no particular order, but number one would be to glorify Him. I think He created something that would then reflect and bring glory to Himself. And number two, I think He wanted fellowship with something. He wanted a creation, a being that He would be able to love and have fellowship with. And though that brings a tremendous amount of meaning to life, and to then walk with Him and gain insight, gain understanding, be taught the difference between right and wrong. And it's also like we have no chance of ever reaching the pinnacle and then being bored for the rest of our life. It's don't worry about that. We have a lot to learn from him, more than a lifetime would be able to handle. All this is completely absent without a belief in a God, in this case, a personal God. Another term you might have heard is, how do we go from an is to an ought? Like science can teach us something is this way, but science or a worldview absent God can never tell us how something ought to be. That's what I mean by when you love mercy and seek justice and go around, you see that this ought to be like that. Well, you ought not have tripped him on the train. That's where that comes in. And then the last question. So we have origin, meaning, origin, morality, meaning, and then the last question is destiny. And I'm not going to spend much time on this. I'm almost done. And that is what happens when this is all over. What happens when we die? And this is another question that humanity has never been able to ignore. Pretty much every religion since ancient times has believed in some sort of an afterlife. There has to be more than this. It's inherent to us. And I part of the reason I don't have that much to say is because I don't, and I would say none of us really do know exactly what it's like, or what the afterlife is. But I want to read this another quote from C.S. Lewis. He said, "If we find ourselves with a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that we were made for another world." And that, I believe, is the truth. That's why there are things on earth that will never fulfill us ultimately, and why this simple book, I shouldn't say simple book, but why this can, for thousands and thousands of years, this can continue to bring meaning and relevance and comfort to people, is because it answers a question that is not found in this world. And I think it proves that we're ultimately meant for another place. So that was the last question, and I like to, every teaching, I think one should ask after that, well, what does this mean for me? There was another, was it Francis Schaeffer who said, "How should we then live?" He had that series, I don't know when, but that's a question that you can ask yourself regarding all this, in the, having just heard this. How should I then live? How should it affect my life going forward? And for me, it's the reason that I keep doing this, that I go to church, and that it's like if you only go to church for the fellowship or the fun or the beauty of it, there will be times when the fellowship is kind of so-so and there are things that are not beautiful, and then you will stop going. But that's not the reason I go. I don't think it's not a strong reason to go. The reason I continue to meet with believers and discuss these things, the origin of our morality, and how we can draw closer to this person that created us and that wants to fellowship with us. Those are the reasons why we go to church and why we should go to church. And also it should drive us towards the Bible to read and to learn more. This is probably the number one way that God would reveal himself to us and his nature. And there's a lot there. And you can, people dedicate their lives to reading it, and they're continually amazed by it. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then to flip that around, without these things, our lives would be very insignificant and meaningless. But assuming we do believe them, it's a huge contradiction and very hypocritical to then not take it seriously. It makes it incredibly significant. It makes the choices in our daily lives incredibly significant, because both in the span of eternity, our life is this big, and since we are told that it's significant and we believe that now, we better make something of it, because this is the one life that God has given us. So find out what that thing is that God would have you do, and then as we learned this morning, do it with work. With the work that you have, do it with all your heart. That is another takeaway from this. I think I will stop there. That is all I had, unless there are questions or comments.